This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Influence of the Dead on Destiny. This is Lecture 2, entitled Concerning the World of the Dead, given in Dornach on December 9th, 1917. During these lectures, we will consider certain matters that will culminate, tomorrow or the next day, in a discussion of historical necessity and freedom. We will see in what sense an historical event is necessary, and in what sense such an event as something that intervenes in the human soul life could happen in a different way. Indeed, today, when such important events intervene in human life, this is a problem of especially deep significance. For in face of the sad, catastrophic events of the present day, World War I, we all must indeed ask ourselves, how much do such happenings depend on a certain necessity? And how could the present events have turned out differently had they been able to take a different form? It will be our aim during these lectures to reply to this large, inclusive question with knowledge based on esoteric foundations that may be discussed publicly. But we must proceed from a more inclusive observation of human life. It is a prerequisite that we must deepen ourselves somewhat from a certain side in human nature itself. For as you perhaps understood from the lectures held recently, forces that come from the world between death and a new birth play constantly into human life. The forces in which the so-called dead are embedded play much more intensely into this life than we imagine. As human beings, we are formed so that the threshold between the everyday physical world and the spiritual world goes right through the middle of the human being. If we contemplate our everyday life, which we considered the last time more from the physical side and today more from the side of the soul, then we may say, while we are incarnated here in the physical body, we have active in us everything that can be experienced through the senses. Everything spread out around us as a tapestry of matter, about which we receive information through our senses. We then build upon this sense world, which we are also able to penetrate independently in our thought life. When we unite the sense life and the thought life, we have basically everything that constitutes our usual waking consciousness. From the moment we awaken in the morning until the moment we fall asleep, we are truly awake only in our sense impressions and in our thinking. We are not fully awake in our feeling life. And there lies the threshold, practically unnoticed by everyday consciousness, between the thought life and the feeling life. For we are not conscious at all of what penetrates our feeling life as a deeper reality. We are conscious of the feelings themselves. They surge up out of a subconscious world, but we are conscious of them no more than we are of our dreams when we are asleep. As I said recently here in Switzerland, in public lectures, while we live in our feeling life, we are actually sleep and dreaming. The dream life extends itself over into our waking life. We are really in a continuous dream state, from the moment of going to sleep to that of awakening. But we are only conscious of those dreams that are most strongly connected with our physical existence. Only in the deeper layers of our consciousness do we sleep, so to say, dreamlessly. But this dreaming and dreamless sleep life, But this dreaming and dreamless sleep life goes over into our feeling life, into the life of our emotions. And we know no more of the reality, of the actual content of the ordinary consciousness of our feeling life, than we know of what actually occurs when we dream at night. Therefore, we could also say in these lectures that the human being does not inwardly experience the content of what is called history with waking consciousness, but dreams through it. History is a cosmic dream of the human being, for the impulses living in history actually live in feeling and emotional impulses. We dream while we experience history. Thus the life of feeling lies beneath the threshold of the actual waking consciousness. Also in this soul connection, the boundary between the conscious and the subconscious life goes through the middle of the human being. In our will life, we are completely asleep, for we know nothing about what actually lives in the will with our everyday consciousness. Our ordinary consciousness perceives the reality of the will in exactly the same way that it lives in deep sleep. We follow consciously only what comes out of the will and has already gone over into action. In this action, we awaken. In the execution of the will, we cannot awaken. Hence, philosophers continually quarrel about the freedom and the non-freedom of the will, because they cannot penetrate into the realm from which the will really draws its impulses, which can be seen only with clairvoyant consciousness. Thus, I accentuated once more, also in the soul connection, the threshold between the actual physical world of waking life and the world that remains lies in the... Thus I accentuated once more, also in the soul connection, the threshold between the actual physical world of waking life and the world that remains lies in the middle of the human being. Now everything we experience between death and a new birth plays right into our life of the feeling and the will, that is, into what we sleep and dream through. The experiences of the dead are actually in the world where we live in feeling and willing. Only we do not know, with our ordinary consciousness, the realities that live in feeling and willing. If we could live through the reality of the feeling life, and especially the reality of the willing life, just as in waking we live through the reality of the sense perceptions and the thought conceptions, the conceptions to a lesser degree, then those who have died would be just as much in continual connection with us as someone who is with us here on the physical plane. And we would be able to receive impressions from the dead in our waking consciousness through our senses and thought life. What is living in the impulses of the dead juts continually into our feeling life and into the life of our will impulses. And only because we miss it by dreaming and sleeping through it do we feel separated from the dead. Fundamentally, however, the world of the so-called dead is quite different from the world of those incarnated in the physical body. Ask yourself in a thought-filled way, what then exists for the waking, non-clairvoyant consciousness from the time of waking until going to sleep? The answer is only what we experience in the world, which is spread out as a tapestry of sense impressions, and the world we fashion out of this sense world through our thought conceptions. In the first place, everything of this world, belonging to the so-called mineral kingdom, which we perceive with our sense organs, does not exist directly for the dead. The stars, the sun, and the moon, for example, belong to this mineral world. In general, everything belongs to it that is perceptible to the senses. A large region of the plant world belongs to it also. These are primarily regions that do not lie open to the spiritual and soul eyes of the dead. On the other hand, the soul eyes of the dead are open to the world that we are more or less conscious of, which is veiled by the sense world, that is to say, the world of impulses, of the forces living in the animals. This is the lowest world for the dead, in exactly the same way that the mineral world is the lowest world for us here in the physical body. Just as for us, the plant world sprouts forth and builds itself up out of the mineral kingdom, so for the dead, the human world builds itself as a soul world out of the foundation of the animal world. And just as the animal kingdom forms the third category for us, based upon the mineral and plant world, so the kingdom of the angels, archangels, and so on, forms a higher kingdom for the dead. Therefore, the dead exist in a different environment than that of human beings living in physical bodies. Just imagine for a moment how it would be if everything you perceive with the senses, about which you form concepts in your physical body, were taken out of the physical world. There would remain, for non-clairvoyant perception, something that can only look like a dream world. It would appear like a world that can only be dreamt, that cannot live any more strongly in the consciousness than a dream. But the distinction becomes clearer if we look at it in yet another way. The essential characteristic of our life in the physical body is that we are conscious that whatever we do with the beings of the mineral and plant remains relatively a matter of indifference to them. We indeed act under the influence of this thought just expressed. We break a stone and have the idea that we do not cause the stone pain or give it any joy. You know that inwardly the matter is somewhat different, but as far as we human beings are in contact with the surrounding mineral world, we think, with a certain justification, that joy and pain are not aroused when we do something like break a stone to pieces. We behave in a similar way to the plant world. There are very few human beings now who, for example, feel a sort of pain or compassion when a flower is plucked. There are very few individuals who prefer to leave the rose on the bush rather than have the rose bouquet in their room. It is with the animal world that we first begin to bring our humanity directly into relationship with the surrounding world. And yet, let it be said once more that it is rare to find human beings today who have even a remotely similar feeling when plucking roses for a bouquet to what they would have tearing off the heads of animals. Even among anthroposophists, I have found that not everyone always prefers to leave roses on the bush, although the feeling has already progressed so far that no one has ever presented me with a bouquet of nightingale heads at a gathering. Here we begin to feel how the life that expands within us continues on into our surrounding world. The dead have no such condition. They feel that everything they do in their environment, be it merely pointing a finger, causes joy or pain. I am describing this quite symbolically and pictorially. They do not enter at all into relationship with their surroundings without awakening everywhere an echo of joy and pain. If you do something after you have passed through the portals of death, your actions always bring about pain or joy somewhere, a tension or relaxation of something that is similar to the feeling life. If we knock on a table, we feel that it does not cause the table pain. The dead can never carry out an action without knowing that they live and weave not only in a living element, but also in a living element filled with feeling. The feeling-filled stimulus is spread out over their entire environment. From another side, you will find this described in the corresponding chapter of my book titled Theosophy. This feeling-filled stimulus world lives thus upon the lowest level in the animal kingdom. And just as we are acquainted with a certain external side of the mineral kingdom through our sense perceptions, so are the dead familiar with the inner side, not with the outer form, but with the inner aspect of the animal life of their whole world. This animal life is the lowest foundation upon which they live and fashion themselves and their existence. And a large amount of the work of the dead consists in placing themselves in direct relationship to the world of living animals. Just as here on earth we place ourselves in connection with the dead mineral world, so do we establish ourselves after death continually in a broad and growing relationship to the world of the living animal. The dead learn to know this world from all sides through having to penetrate step by step all the secrets that here on earth are concealed from them, just as what slumbers beneath their feeling life is concealed from their souls, for it is the same thing. Granted such a question as the one I now intend to interject cannot count as a properly scientific one, but it can, nevertheless, point towards something behind which real relationships exist. We can ask, why then the power of the all-penetrating world wisdom has concealed some things from the human being here in the physical world? We can ask why the mysteries of the building up of the whole animal world into which the dead must be initiated is concealed. Precisely when we attempt to answer such a question, we reach into the deepest mysteries of existence. And we will have to deal with this question in these examinations. First of all, however, we must look at what this comprehending of the inner side of the animal life actually is. Here I might proceed from a fact of recent history, in order not to become theoretical. You know that in a certain external way, human historical consciousness has experienced a change in modern times through Darwinism. There has been an endeavor to find the forces by which organisms evolve from the so-called imperfect to the perfect condition. The Darwinists have named several kinds: the principle of special selection or survival of the fittest, the adaptation to environment, and so on. I do not intend to come to you with these things that you can read in every handbook on Darwinism, even in every encyclopedia. Yet I wish to point out that these are external, abstract principles. For those who look deeper, they impart nothing. Saying that perfection occurs through the selection of the fittest, with the others gradually dying out and the fittest surviving, does not show what actually happens. Nothing is said there about the forces or impulses that actually live in the animal kingdom, in order that the animals perfect themselves and also build their life to be suited to the ordinary present-day world. What is really working in the forces of selection put forward by Darwinism as forces that are of a purely mechanical usefulness? The dead are working in them. One of the most astonishing and impressive experiences that can be made in the circle of the dead is to discover that just as here there are smiths, joiners, and others who work in the world of mechanics and handwork, and thereby create the physical, sense-perceptible foundation of life here, so in the spirit realm the dead work, beginning with the animal kingdom on upward. While the animal kingdom here, in many respects, is seen as inferior, with the mineral world lying still lower, the very basis of the work of the dead is the furthering of the animal kingdom. Therefore the dead immerse themselves in all the skillfulness that is concealed from them in the life between birth and death. We come here to the point that was held more or less secret until our age by the brotherhoods that believed, partly justly and partly unjustly, that other human beings were not ready for such things. If you gain the knowledge of what is related to the animal nature in the world of the dead, you then see that all this is the feeling-filled living element. Human beings also have this feeling-filled living element in their souls, but in what way? Between birth and death, for that is where it exists, they possess this element in such a way that were it not locked up in their unconsciousness, they could at every moment employ it for the destruction of the remainder of this living element in the world. Just imagine what that really means. You have in your personal life a feeling-filled living element that is enclosed in the boundaries of the physical human being. If human beings were generally to have this element freely at their disposal, (anthroposophists will already be more cultivated in this regard, then they could employ these concealed forces at any time to destroy the feeling-filled living element around them. The animal nature in the human being is primarily, even in the best sense, a destructive one. And when human beings have passed through death's door, it is their task, above all, to tear out of their soul all the impulses that have then become free, so that a great deal of desire to destroy the living, to kill the living, remains. And it can be said that to have respect and reverence for all living things is something that the departed must learn above all. This reverence for everything living is something that can be looked upon as the self-evident development of the dead. Here we can follow children with deep interest, and can see how they develop in a self-evident manner, gradually from day to day and week to week, and how the soul takes hold of the physical body, and can be deeply joyful about what occurs without the so-called free will, what takes place through purely organic forces of the soul. So too, when we follow the course taken by the dead from the day of their death onward through their life after death, we again behold a development withdrawn from the free will. It is the development of the deepest reverence for all living things, living beings in the surroundings. This is something that, so to speak, happens like an external side in the dead, just as with the child this occurs as an external side through its growing up, by its traits becoming more expressive. What grows up externally in the child, to our joy, grows similarly in the dead, in that more and more they hold every living thing to be sacred in such an edifying way. In this connection there is an important difference between life after death and life here on earth. The life here on earth has concealed by a veil just what the dead must deepen in themselves. We perceive the world through our senses, and form for ourselves certain laws that we call the laws of nature, according to which we then build our mechanical instruments and tools. What we erect around us, according to the laws of nature, is essentially a world of death. We must even kill the plant, even the tree, when we wish to place its wood at the service of our mechanical arts. And again, it belongs to the most distressing knowledge that basically everything that our senses teach us, when we apply it by means of our will, is something destructive, and cannot be anything else but destructive. Even when we create a work of art, we must take part in the world of destruction. What we thus create first arises out of destruction. A beneficent world wisdom has only caused us at first to shrink back, as human beings, from placing what lives from the animal world upward at the service of mechanical art. In a certain higher sense, however, everything lives in the world. You will already realize this from the various accounts given over the years. But what do we actually do when we place what we perceive through our senses and combine through our intellect at the service of mechanical art? We continually carry death into life. Even a Raphael painting cannot come into being unless death is carried into life. More was living before a Raphael painting arose than after it came into being. In the universe, this is compensated only through the fact that souls come who enjoy the Raphael painting and receive from it an impulse, an impression. Only the impulse, the impression that the creating or enjoying soul receives, can help to overcome the effect of death, even when the highest treasures, the so-called highest spiritual possessions of humanity, are created here on the physical plane. Essentially, the earth will be destroyed, because human beings carry death into the earth in such strong measure through their mechanical arts. The earth will no longer be able to live, because the forces of death prevail over what can be saved from the destruction of the physical earth and carried over into the Jupiter stage. But out of what human beings have created by weaving together death and life, they will have regained a soul content that they will then carry over into the Jupiter existence. Death, or the destruction of what is living, continually weaves into life more than words can say. It weaves in human activity itself, because between birth and death, this human activity is intimately interwoven with sense existence. Indeed, consciousness arises because death weaves itself into life. We would not accomplish our task on earth, as far as consciousness is concerned, if we did not weave death into life. Even within ourselves, we kill the life of the nerves whenever we form a thought, because a really living nerve cannot form thoughts. In recent public lectures, I have said that we enter into the life of our nerves through a constant death process. In this respect, the life between death and a new birth is the exact opposite. There, it is essential for the human soul to become accustomed to holding all that is living as holy, and to permeate the living with more and more life. In this manner, the life between birth and death is connected with death, and the life between death and a new birth is connected with the whole of life. Animals exist on the earth only because human beings die and send their impulses from the spiritual world into the life of the animals. The second thing that human beings become familiar with after death is the kingdom of human souls. Regardless of whether these human souls are embodied here in physical bodies or have already passed through the gate of death. After death, human beings face the animal world with a feeling that when the dead carry out an action, something experiences joy or another being suffers. They know that they strike against living reality, even when they strike only with their spiritual force. Here, it is more a universal living and weaving within a living element. In relation to the human sphere, after we are dead, when another soul enters into a relationship with us after we ourselves have died, we become aware that our own life feeling is either strengthened or diminished according to the way we meet this soul. Through our relation to a certain soul, regardless of whether it dwells here upon the earth or in the spiritual world, we feel that we become inwardly strengthened, our inner forces become stronger, and at the same time more alive. We meet a soul and feel that it makes us more awake than we would have been otherwise. An intense sense of life streams toward us with a certain intensity through our acquaintance with this soul. The relationship with another soul may weaken us in the direction of certain forces and dim down our life to an extent. After death, we feel ourselves surging with life in this relationship with other souls. We live out our life of feeling and will as human beings between birth and death, without knowing that the souls of the dead live in the waves of this life of feeling and will, which we sleep through and dream away. The dead are always there. They live in the waves of our own feeling and will, and they live there in such a way that they experience this life with us. While we experience the surrounding world through our senses as something external, the dead live in the impulses of our feelings and will. They are far more intimately bound together with us than we, as far as we are physically embodied, are bound together with our surroundings. It is so that this life, or better, this experiencing, this inner presence in life of the dead, develops gradually in accordance with the conditions that were developed during our life here. We truly live together with all souls after death. This is true. But we know nothing about it. Relationships set in slowly and gradually with souls that we were connected with during our life between birth and death. We cannot form new original relationships with other human beings during the life between death and a new birth. We cannot begin new connections directly. When we have loved or hated someone here on earth, when we were connected with them, either in a positive or in a negative way, this again rises from a gray spiritual depth in the gradual awakening of the life after death. Thus a great part of this experiencing, of this inner life presence of the dead, formed by our connections with other souls during our most recent incarnations, gradually emerges out of a gray spiritual depth. This can extend out, in the case of many departed souls, very soon after death, but indirectly. Suppose we die. We may have had some kind of relationship to a soul dwelling either on the earth or in the spiritual world. This relationship meets us once more after death, in the way indicated. But this soul with whom we are linked has relationships with other souls, whom we perhaps have never met during any of our lives between birth and death. We can then indirectly form a relationship with the so-called dead. But as I have already said, these are never direct connections, for they are always mediated by the souls with whom we are linked karmically through our physical life. The connection with souls where no relationship has been established during physical life is always quite a different one and is transmitted through the soul who was connected with us in physical life. You can now easily imagine that first there are the direct relationships present, and then the indirect relationships. However, because all souls are more or less connected with one another over all the earth, and during our long life between death and a new birth we form, indirectly at least, many new connections, we human beings have extensive experience with other souls, if we also take into account the indirect relationships. Even when we are here on earth, we have already within us this living into other souls. In the spiritual world we have lived together with innumerable souls, over and over again. The feeling of being at one with all souls, which an abstract philosophy considers only as an abstract at-oneness, has its quite concrete side. There are scarcely any souls over the whole earth with whom we do not have at least a distant, indirect connection. We must grasp this fact as concretely as possible, and then this will lead us to something real. What the dead experience is a gradual waking up into a world based, in a wider sense, on their karma. An inward brightness increases more and more, spreading over this world as our experiences become richer in this second realm built upon the animal realm, just as our experiences with the plant realm are built on the mineral realm. Our experiences become ever richer and richer. Imagine this experience extending into all concrete connections, and you will grasp something of what permeates the soul of the departed between death and a new birth. All thoughts that connect us karmically in any way with other souls are bound up with this experience. In this lies an infinitely rich world. Essentially, during the first half of this life, between death and a new birth, we are increasingly filled with wisdom. Aside, you will gather this from the lecture cycle titled The Inner Nature of Man and Life Between Death and Rebirth, Collected Works, Volume 153, close aside. In a wise way, human beings become accustomed to the connections that they gradually draw up again out of the gray spiritual depth. They become familiar with all of this in a very wise way. The threads leading to all direct or indirect karmic relationships begin in what I called in the mystery dramas, quote, the midnight hour of being, close quote. As the dead further develop this wisdom, something similar to the will, but only similar, not the same, enters into the life of the soul. This element of force, similar to the will, makes the human beings stronger and stronger. Above all, it strengthens in them those impulses added to the wisdom-filled survey of the world as elements and impulses of the will, as strength impulses. Now something peculiar enters in. A certain form of will becomes active in human beings during the second half of the life between death and a new birth. If we observe this will, we can do this especially in the case of souls who, through various circumstances, have a shorter life between death and a new birth. We find that the will takes a peculiar direction, arising to cover up, in a way, the traces of our life, the traces of karma. Please grasp this quite clearly. Such a will, working to cover up the traces of karma, becomes more and more evident in the human being. This effacement of karmic traces is connected with the deepest secrets of life, human life. If human beings always had a full survey of the wisdom that they can acquire soon after death, then there would be countless human beings who would prefer to cover up the traces of their existence rather than to enter into new lives. The processing of our earlier lives into a karmic connection can only be accomplished because we are dulled down by certain beings of the higher hierarchy during the second half of the life between death and a new birth. We are paralyzed with regard to the light of wisdom, so that we restrict our activity and our will impulses more and more. The aim of this restriction is to ensure that we create what can then unite with a physical human body in the stream of heredity, and can live out its earthly destiny in this physical body. We can only understand these thoughts fully when we consider earthly destiny itself. How dreamlike this earthly destiny is for the human being on earth. As children, we gradually accustom ourselves to the conditions of earthly life. What we call destiny comes to us in the form of individual life experiences. Out of the fabric of these life experiences, something is formed that is, in reality, the human being itself. Think what you would be today if you had not lived through your own particular destiny. You can indeed say, I myself am what I have experienced as destiny. For you would be quite another human being if you had experienced a different destiny. And yet how foreign destiny seems to be, how little interwoven with what we call our capital I. Why does the I feel itself struck by destiny countless times? Because what we ourselves do to mold our own destiny remains hidden in the subconsciousness. What we experience takes up its place in the world of sense experience and in the world of thoughts. It merely strikes against our feeling life, and our feeling life remains passive to this. What we have in common with the realm of the dead springs forth actively out of our feeling life, and out of the life of the will impulses. What springs forth in this way, and what we ourselves do without our consciousness by dreaming and sleeping through it, forms our destiny. We ourselves are this. We dream and sleep through all we do in molding our own destiny. We wake in what we experience as our destiny, but only because it remains subconscious. What is it that remains, in reality, subconscious? What remains subconscious comes across as impulses out of earlier incarnations on earth, and out of the life between death and a new birth, in a purely spiritual way, from where the dead are found. We dream and sleep through it. At the same time, these are forces that come also from ourselves. They are the forces with which we mold our destiny. We weave our destiny out of the same realm that the dead inhabit in common with us. Think how we grow together with this world, of which we now know to a certain extent, how we sleep through it and how we experience it, although we have not yet spoken of the experiences in connection with the beings of the higher hierarchies. This will also be considered, but what I wish to convey through a discussion is that we must place the realm of the so-called dead within the same realm where we ourselves live, and that we become conscious of the fact that we feel separated from the dead, though in reality we are not, only because we dream and sleep through our feeling life and will life where the dead also are. Yet, still something else can be found in this world that we dream and sleep through, that is not normally perceived in our usual consciousness. Sometimes we become aware of this when it occurs in specially striking cases, but these are individual sensational cases that only draw attention to what is always permeating life and streaming through it. You yourselves will have heard of many cases resembling the following one. Someone has the habit of taking a daily walk. It leads him onto a mountain slope. He goes there every day. It is his special pleasure. One day he goes there again as usual. Suddenly, while he is walking, he hears something like a voice, although it is not a physical voice, that says to him, "Why are you walking along this path? Can you really not do without this pleasure?" He hesitates and turns aside to think over what has just happened to him. In this instant, a piece of rock rolls down that would have struck him had he not turned aside. This is a true story, but one that only points out sensationally something that is always present in our lives. How often do you plan to do this or that, but something prevents you? Think how many things would have been different, even in the smallest experiences of life, if you had not started out at an appointed hour instead of half an hour later, because something detained you. Think what changes have come in this way into your life and into the lives of many other people. It is quite easy to picture this. Let us suppose that you have planned to meet another person somewhere at 3:45 p.m. to tell him some news which he in turn would have told to someone else. Because you came too late, you do not tell him this news, and you then see that something was prevented. Certain very important things do not happen. Here we see a universal order different from that described as a necessity of nature. We feel that here a different world order is at work, when someone is prevented from continuing his walk because he hears a voice that causes him to turn aside and thus saves him from being struck dead by the falling piece of rock. But this world order always permeates our existence, not merely when such sensational events take place. Even in such instances, we are accustomed to looking only at the sensational occurrences. Why do we not notice this other world? Because we turn our gaze toward the events that occur in our life and in our surroundings, and not toward the events that do not occur, to the events that are continually being prevented. At a certain level of spiritual development, what does not happen, what is held back from us or what we are protected from, can rise up in our consciousness in the same way as what does happen. It is only that it comes to our consciousness as another world order. Try to place this world order before your soul by saying to yourself, "We are accustomed to look only at what happens and not at what has been prevented from happening. What we do not notice is intimately connected with the realm of the dead, where we ourselves live in our dreamlike feeling and sleeping will. Within us we cut ourselves off from this other world, because dream and sleep also play into our waking life. All that seethes, lives, and weaves beneath the boundary, separating our thinking from our feeling, contains at the same time the secrets that build not only the bridge between the so-called living and the so-called dead, but also the bridge between the realm of necessity and the realm of freedom, and of so-called accident or chance." The end of Lecture 2.